Hello and welcome to Scoppy Radio. My name is Daniel Johansson, and there is no Maureen Smith. I like almost gave the second of preparatory, like, let's let Maureen talk, and then I was like, oh my god. So I'm here alone tonight, today. You're hearing this probably in the morning. It's been a crazy weekend. We're actually headed out to Milwaukee over the next few days. But we had reached out to Heidi Jostin, who's here now.
Yes.
Hello, Heidi.
Hello.
Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, no problem. And she was like, I still really want to come on. And we were like, we still really want you to come on. And so then I reached out to Emma Cox to co-host with me, and then I reached out to Josh Smith to co-host with me, and they were both like, nah. Not because they didn't want to, but just because, I don't know, life or something. But so anyway, so we're here now, and I'm really glad that we are, that we were able to find a time that worked at all, because first off, you're so fucking busy.
Yeah, I work about 100 hours a week.
Yeah, you kill... That's the... Like, I know you... from so many different experiences. Like, you do so many different things. Like, we were actually co-workers for a spell.
Sure.
Like, you're a recording engineer. You are a composer. You are a harpist. You're, like, a pianist / accompanist. Like, are there other things that I'm missing?
I have a corporate day job for health insurance.
Okay.
As well.
Cool. Do you have... Is it experience? Is it kind of like a thing that started as a temp job kind of deal?
I got hired through a temp agency,
mm-hmm.
but it is a full-time gig for insurance, and
cool.
It's given me a gazillion admin skills that have proven to be very, very valuable in the arts world.
Yeah, I think that's amazing. Sometimes there are just certain things that are not, like, arts school skill sets that you don't learn about until you're not in school anymore, and administration especially. I feel like... And I got it in a way with art stuff, but like when I did Opera on Tap, that was that way where it was just like I'd never run an organization before.
Sure.
Anyway, cool. Well, one of the other things that I know you also have upcoming is the Appetite Concerto.
Yes.
Which I'm really excited about hearing more about, just because at its name level, it sounds so... It's like immediately sounds so you. Like, people that know
yeah.
you, I'm sure, are like, oh, this is amazing.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So do you mind telling us a
little
bit? Sure,
yeah. I would love to talk about this. The Appetite Concerto was my master's thesis. I graduated in 2016 from Roosevelt University with a master's degree in composition. And in order to get your master's in composition, you have to write a thesis of a specific size. So you could write a certain length electronic piece, you could write a certain length chamber piece. They didn't want you to graduate with like a 20-minute piano solo. You needed experience writing for multiple instruments or multiple timbres with electroacoustic. And I chose to go way above and beyond and wrote a 4-movement harp concerto with wind ensemble. And my reasoning behind that is in my undergrad, I was a harp minor,
mm-hmm.
and I got all of my large ensemble credits through wind ensemble. So while I did play with the orchestra on occasion, I loved joining the wind ensemble. And the more that I was looking into repertoire for a young undergraduate harpist, I realized everything there was dead.
Yeah.
It was all dead white guys. It was all music that had been written hundreds of years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wanted to kind of bridge the gap by creating a solo piece for a younger harpist. It's still a difficult piece, but you can learn a lot from it. Teachers can say, okay, this is the specific technique I want you to use here, and it can further your skill set without being a piece that would kill a harpist,
mm-hmm.
as well as it's a piece that would work for a, you know, sophomore to junior
right.
undergraduate wind ensemble.
Cool. I love the... I'm so glad we got to have you on, because one of the things that I think is a conversation that a lot of organizations are having right now, especially new music organizations, is that conversation that you started to bring up, which is how fraught with white dead men the classical music canon is. And, you know, I think that it's there are movements to both kind of vault pre-existing female composers, like, you know, Hildegard von Bingen, Strozzi, I feel like has made a huge resurgence in the last, like, decade.
Absolutely.
But, you know, there's just something to be said about going to what's being made now. I commend you because you very much put yourself out there. you put your work out there. Like, you just did the performance with Emma Cox.
I did, yes.
What was that one called?
She's done, like, the four. Starving Artist.
Right.
And I also did her Swipe Left, the second installment. Yeah. That was so much fun.
Cool. Sorry, I'm like, trying to pet my cat. Okay. I'm, like, a very selfish interviewer where, like, I have someone, and then my cat comes up, and I'm like, I'm going to pet the cat.
It's fine. Better you than me.
Yeah. Yeah, you're much, because I do remember that about you, that you're a dog person, pretty much, right? I'm
very much a dog person.
Yeah. It's camps, right? Like, it's...
You know, some people like Mozart, some people like Puccini.
Yeah.
Some people like both.
Are you a big dog person or a little dog person?
I am a dog person.
Yeah.
So, if they exist, I like them.
Right.
Cool. Yeah.
I'm a big, have you ever seen on Instagram John Hanau's dog?
Oh my gosh, me too.
Such a good dog.
Yeah.
She's, I love that guy.
She's a keeper.
Yeah, that's a good dog. I've never met that dog. I just see, because I love huskies. I, like, was a low-key Tumblr kid at, like, 21. And so I had that, there was a few husky blogs that I followed just for the pics. So, like, real talk, listeners at home, please send me pictures of huskies. I will love that. Because I have two cats, and I love cats, but I'm not, like, solely a cat person. Like, I play both sides of that debate.
Sure.
Yeah, anyway. Sorry, I just entirely went off on a tangent. Tell me the conceit of the Appetite Concerto.
Sure. So, oh my gosh, where do I start? One of the issues I have with classical music is that it, especially newer classical music, is that it oftentimes takes itself too seriously.
Mm.
Now, I have written very serious classical pieces, and I will continue to write serious classical pieces, but I feel like so much is lost in the name of things, where it sometimes tries to be too academic or too higher ivory tower.
No, yeah.
Where, you know, classical musicians wrote jokes into their music as well. Sometimes life is, you have to not take it as seriously. Mm-hmm. And so I love puns. I love making fun of different things. And I grew up in a family of all classical musicians. Both of my parents were high school music teachers who are now college professors. My brother is a band director just south of Madison, and my sister is going into her super senior year of being a choir director.
Cool.
And so we grew up with very, very serious music education backgrounds, but we don't take each other seriously at all.
Yeah.
We are the perfect blend of the Partridge Family and It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia.
Mm.
So in writing my master's thesis, when you write a big piece of music, you have to spend a lot of time with it. You have to spend, at least for the masters at Roosevelt, they want you to spend 6 months at the minimum with this piece. Mm. And if you're writing something really serious, that can take you to mental places, just physical places, where you get really intense, and it's a lot of mental stress to write a piece of that magnitude and be able to develop everything and tie it back in at a master's of music education level. And so I knew from the get-go, my attention span is about as long as your cat's claw. It's just non-existent, my attention span. So if I was going to get bogged down with a piece of music, I needed something lighthearted to keep me involved with it, to keep me attached to it. And so with all of the movements of the concerto, the longest one is like 7 minutes. So for a contemporary concerto, that's not long at all. That's very short.
Mm-hmm.
And I needed to tie that into everything. All the movements were going to be relatively short, really accessible. And I was thinking a petite, something small, and it made sense to me that I was going to go with Appetite. It's a play on a petite concerto.
I didn't catch that first.
Ha
ha! Yeah. No, I just loved the idea of the implied variety of it too.
Sure. Yeah. And that was another aspect to it. So when I settled on the idea of the Appetite Concerto, I said, great, I'm gonna write about food. Food is the number three love of my life. I spend too much time with it, too much money on it. And I grew up in a town of 1,500 people.
Mm.
When you grow up in a town that small, you become very attached to your mother's cooking because you don't go out that often because there aren't that many restaurants, aren't that many cuisines to try. So I moved from there to the city of Chicago and my tongue exploded. And so all of the pieces in this concerto are four of my ultimate favorites that also have a very sentimental value according to when, when I moved here. And so they're all very carb loaded and very Wisconsin to a certain extent.
I think, have I heard maybe one of them? Is one of them deep dish pizza?
It is. Pepperoni and spinach deep dish pizza from Pequod's in Lincoln Park.
What's the, oh, that's a good spot. Yeah. When I, so I, story, background story for Daniel. I am vegan. I've been vegan for 3 years, but there was a year I lived in Chicago where I wasn't yet. I was only vegetarian. And I went there for, they had a good spinach pie.
Yeah.
I was like, love pizza. Like, mm-hmm.
I feel like you can't be in Chicago and not love pizza.
It's hard.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I started watching this Munchies. You know Munchies, like the Vice?
No.
So have you heard of Vice?
Yes.
It's like an HBO-based kind of like news outlet thing.
Sure.
But they have a, I don't know if it's just YouTube. I don't have HBO, so like I don't really know anything about it. I have a lot of favorite YouTube channels. So they do Munchies, and what they did was a 6-episode arc of pizza. And so obviously it's this like Brooklyn-based New York pizza maker, but he does an episode in Chicago.
Okay.
And it was so cool because he went to Lou Malnati's and like talked to the owner of Lou Malnati's, who was kind of a weird dude. He's even fine. I mean, like, I'm not trying to like start a fight with Lou Malnati's on my podcast right now, but he also went to a lot of like tavern spots in a lot of different neighborhoods, especially like in the South Side. And sure. It was so cool to kind of like actually see him see what Chicago calls thin crust too, because there is such a strong thin crust tradition too. Pizza okay. in Chicago is just amazing in that it is like, I just love that your concerto is that too, because it is such a powerful metaphor, is that like moment of moving here and then just like kind of exploring all of the food palettes. So what is the story behind pepperoni and spinach?
Sure. So pepperoni and spinach deep dish pizza is the second movement of my thesis. And that one specifically is, how do I best describe this? For those that are listening, that are music people, it has a ridiculously long opening development section. Mm. Because if you order from Pequod's, they tell you it's going to take at least 45 minutes for you to get your pizza. So it begins, and you don't really know where the material is going. It kind of wanders. It builds in intensity as your hunger builds. And then eventually the pizza gets to the table and it's just elation. This is probably my most programmatic movement.
Mm.
Pizza gets to the table and everybody's happy and they're eating it and it's great. And then it goes back through a little bit more turmoil where you as the eater have to just figure out if you have it within you to eat another piece. Because realistically, one piece is probably the best portion size, but eventually you do give way and you eat the second piece, and it's almost got kind of like a Great Gate of Kiev feel.
Mm-hmm.
As you're finishing that up, and at the end it's the never-ending question of why did I do that to myself.
Have you had the thing that is like it got popular after I went vegan, the thing that is like a bubble of cheese, is it a grinder thing? Do you know what I'm talking about?
I think I do. I'm sure somewhere I've seen it.
It looks kind of like a deep dish, but instead of the sauce on top, it's just like a mountain of cheese that comes out of it. Not even a mountain, kind of just like a well-placed hill of cheese.
If that exists in Chicago, that's a perfect first date for me, listeners. Yeah. Just letting you all know right now.
Shout out, single men.
I mean, let's be honest, my relationship status is otherwise engaged because I'm too busy to date. But
I mean, that's a really real thing.
Yeah.
No, it's fucking hard. I like, Maureen and I have spells where we're both not busy, and then we have spells where we're extremely busy, and it's like, we feel like we barely see each other sometimes.
Sure.
I mean, we do the podcast together and stuff, but I mean, there's something to be said about, like, working on a podcast together versus, like, you know, sitting and watching Netflix. You
sure.
know what I mean? Like, anyway, so I don't know where I got worn off on that, but I'm curious, speaking of Milwaukee and Wisconsin. You're from Wisconsin originally,
yes,
right? Yeah, did you spend a lot of time coming down to Chicago when you were younger, or did you move to Chicago and it was kind of like a...
That's a very good question. I specifically remember a few trips with my family where we came to the city, and when I was in high school, my parents, who were my music teachers, brought their jazz groups, so the jazz choir and jazz band. I was a part of both of the, part of both of them, and we came to Chicago. That was in, oh my gosh, 2006, because I remember that we saw Wicked when it was here. But other than that, we passed through Chicago on our way to the Ann Arbor area every Thanksgiving, because I have family out there. But I didn't really visit Chicago that often to make it, to realize how close it was to where I actually grew up.
That's a really interesting thought. And it's something that I think is a few people are talking about politically, too, because there is such a weird divide between rural and urban lifestyles.
Sure.
Yeah, I know. So my family lives on Long Island, which is the, like, long stretch of island that is, like, right east of New York City.
Sure.
And it's so interesting because, like, when I was growing up, I lived there until I was 10. We never went into the city just because, like, I guess you always know it's there. But I also think there's just, like, it's daunting. Like, it's hard to find parking. It's, like, why would you do it if you didn't have to? And I think that that's something that a lot of people that live in the city don't always recognize that there is that divide. What are your thoughts? Please, I'm like just kind of pontificating the nature of.
I'm a terrible person to talk about rural life with. Mostly, well, here's why. My parents, who are my best friends and were just amazing rock stars, understood for the kids that they had, me, my brother, and my sister, that we craved culture from a very young age. So I grew up 90 miles east of Minneapolis. We went into Minneapolis all the time. I remember my first symphony concert. I remember seeing shows over there. We'd go to Chanhassen Dinner Theater once a year or more to see shows. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, I grew up in a one-stoplight town. My graduating class was 54. But I never felt that I was lacking in culture because my parents were so amazing about taking us to travel, making sure that we saw the world. And yeah, there is a definite culture thing where I go home and people are still amazed that I live in Chicago because the news makes them think that it's a war-torn jungle.
Yeah.
And yes, Chicago has its problems. I'm not going to speak for anybody in this city in solving its problems. But the people here take care of you very much the same that they would in northern Wisconsin. So, like, I fell off the Michigan Avenue bus last week and severely sprained my ankle. And people there took care of me so well. They saw me fall. They grabbed my belongings. They made sure I was okay.
Yeah.
I had to tell three people, don't call an ambulance because I don't know if I have enough in my HSA for that. And at the same time, the tornadoes that went through Wisconsin really recently, that was a mile south of where I grew up. And watching my community just come together, take care of themselves, the amount of donations that have poured in, and yes, there's a lot of work to be done and a lot of cleanup to do, but human nature is human nature. And it's a really beautiful thing to watch how people truly come together when tragedy strikes.
Yeah, I love that you said that. Because I think that's just, I know I talk to my family about living in the city, and I know they'll have sometimes, like, be fearful for that, and it's like, how do you even explain, I mean, like, I could try to, like, go into detail about why it is that, yes, Chicago is a, like, violence-plagued city, but also segregation is so deeply embedded in the roots of this culture that, like, I live in Andersonville, and, like, it's mostly white, and I don't ever feel not safe. And I mean, like, most people, well, if you live on the north side, for the most part, I mean, obviously there are exceptions, but you end up living in these bubbles of these neighborhoods, and it's both fantastic and both terrible. And already I'm boring myself with talking about this, because, and I couldn't imagine, like, I can't, when I talk to my mom about it, I go into the first sentence of that, of my, like, why Chicago was not as violent as Fox News makes it seem. And she's like, I don't care. And not because she doesn't care, but it's just like, and I'm interested in what brought your family to small town living? Because that's really cool to me.
Oh, goodness. How far back do I have to go? In my hometown, my grandfather was the ELCA minister for 25 years.
Okay.
So he took a call there. And it just so happened that my dad, first year out of college, took the band director job and was only planning to stay a year. And then met the pastor's daughter, who was also in school for music. Mm-hmm. And they fell in love. And that's the end of that story.
Right.
But yeah, that was what drove or what caused them to live in Cameron, Wisconsin. And Cameron is an amazing town where it's so wonderful to raise a family there. The school district is great. It's in the middle of the Blue Hills. It's just beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're craving a life where you can see the stars at night, you can enjoy a 5-minute drive to just about anything that you would need.
Right.
The nearest Starbucks was 53 miles from my home, so choose your needs. But it was, it was really beautiful. We actually, I was just back there last weekend, because my parents decided to move.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were able to, like, say goodbye to our childhood home, and we're still going to be involved in the community there, involved in church. But, yeah, it's, I have very endearing feelings toward the town that I grew up in,
mm-hmm.
knowing that I'll be a city girl for probably the rest of my life.
It's really hard. It's really hard when you move to the city to not, I like didn't realize how much I needed it. You know, for some reason I've been feeling really nostalgic over the past couple weeks and thinking about, like, I spent a lot of time in Orlando, which is definitely kind of metropolitan, but it's not like, you know, this where so many different, I was talking to, I've told this story on the show, but, I was talking to my Lyft driver when I was late to get to this interview with you today about this piano, where I got it on Craigslist by emailing 30 different people that were giving away pianos for free.
Sure.
And, it's amazing because it's only in places like Chicago that, like, something like that can happen. Like, I mean, sure, there are people giving away pianos all the time in smaller towns, but, like, I did it in the span of, like, 10 hours. I started emailing it. Mm-hmm. 10 a.m. or 9 a.m. or something like that. And then that night for a performance had the piano ready. And so it's like,
I think I remember that. That was for New Brew, right?
It was for New Brew.
Yep.
Yeah, it was crazy. It was awesome, though. Like, one of my favorite stories of all time. I'm so glad, too, that we talked so much about kind of where you came from, because I love when, as you're talking about this Appetite Concerto, I love where it sits for you as in a referential point of, like, kind of exploring the Chicago and exploring cuisine and stuff. Mm-hmm. So do you mind going a little more? So we've got...
Sure, we've got the second one.
Yeah.
The first one is a total shout-out to Roosevelt.
Okay.
So the first one is the Cortadito from Cafecito. So not really Wisconsin, I misspoke earlier. But yeah. Cafecito was right across the street from Roosevelt, as I'm sure you remember. And yeah. I am not at all a morning person.
Mm-hmm.
My day job is trying really hard to get me to be a morning person, and not yet. And so when I would have morning classes at Roosevelt, I would walk over with friends of mine, and I would double fist Cafecito just to get myself awake in the morning to make sure that I was taking in all of the information that my professors were trying to give me.
Yeah.
And I fell in love with Cuban espresso.
It's so good.
It is so good. And so the Cortadito is a Cuban espresso, a teaspoon of milk, and sugar. So three...
And there's some... Whatever sugar they use...
It's like pure cane sugar. It's brilliant. It's perfect. And I needed a very flashy opener. And so I looked at a bunch of different harp concertos, and the one harp concerto that's, you know, it's the Rock 3 of piano concertos.
Right.
Like, or Rock 3 of harp concertos. And it's the Ginastera harp concerto. And it's brilliant. It's got a ton of different flourishes, and it's got an amazing feel to it.
Jordan Thomas just performed.
He did, and he's my soloist for this. So
cool.
Yeah, small world. He killed that. Cool. But what I wanted to do is, because it's, I mean, it comes in like a 5-ounce glass, the Cortadito does. I tried to factor together as much as I could in creating a very flashy Latin-inspired movement, but also as short as I could. So it is in sonata form. It's rather short. Everything comes back. Everything gets slightly shortened as the movement finishes, kind of like when you're amped up on caffeine, your sentences get shorter. Yeah, and it's fun.
Yeah.
So that's that movement.
Shout out Cafecito. So Maureen obviously works in like high-end coffee.
Sure.
But there is just something she... So what she does mostly, though, is working with kind of roasters that have really developed like wine tastings almost of coffee, of finding different flavor notes and stuff like that. But there is just something so special and unique and also amazing about just good Hispanic Cuban coffee.
Yes.
It's just something else entirely.
And it's not anything I ever grew up with.
Right.
Which was kind of fun to explore that.
Mm-hmm. I also love, I mean, I lived in Florida for a while, and I mean, Cuban food in Florida is prevalent. And Cafecito is pretty on the mark.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's really, it seems like it's all Cuban-owned. Shout out Cafecito. If you're in the loop, it's on, like, what is that street that it's on?
It's on Congress and Wabash.
I always get those, I get Congress and Van Buren and all those mixed up.
Sure.
Because of some reason. But anyway, so, Cortadito Cafecito.
Mm-hmm.
Is it called Cortadito at Cafecito?
It is Cortadito at Cafecito. Yep. Cool. All of them is... Every movement is food at a certain place. I wanted to make sure that when I was writing things... Because you can't... I didn't want every movement to be programmatic. I didn't want it to necessarily be, this is what I taste, and you should taste all of this in what I'm writing. It was an inspiration of the food at a certain place with a certain atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
And that's mostly prevalent in the fourth movement, but that was my attempt at all of it.
Yeah.
So those are the first two movements. The third movement is probably the most art music movement that I've written, and that is the Skillet Cookie at Lincoln Station.
Lincoln Station is a cool spot, too. I've only been once.
It's a great... music major hangout.
Yeah.
I realize that a lot of DePaul music majors hang out there, and the Chicago Symphonic Winds, who are premiering the work, they're great people, amazing people. It was started by DePaul grads.
Okay, yeah.
So I spent a lot of time with DePaul students. I was a pianist there for a little bit, and the Lincoln Station's great. It's like Cheers. You walk in and you automatically recognize at least one person.
Mm-hmm.
But when I'd go, I'd get a skillet cookie. And just about every time I'm at the station with people, we're getting into really, really heavy new music conversations.
Cool.
Which are great, but aimed at a very specific type of person. And mm-hmm. the arguments that happen, some people would say are relevant to normal life, others wouldn't. Like, very, very extended technique, you know, where is the future of new music going?
Right.
And so I needed a movement that was slightly darker in tone. I mean, you can play word games as often as you want, but I needed something darker for my sake.
Right.
And this one, as I looked at all of the ingredients in a skillet cookie, I saw that it contained the majority of major food allergens to the human body. So a very specific type of human could eat a skillet cookie and not get sick, which probably could be said by most about most art music audiences today.
Mm-hmm.
And so that one's a chamber movement. I went the David Mislanka route, where it's a woodwind sextet, harp, piano, and two percussion, the woodwind sextet representing the major food allergens.
Mm.
And there's a lot of math in that movement. There's a lot of things weaving in and out, kind of like an argument and conversation. And then at some point, everything cuts out and the harp has a little bit of a dreamlike solo where I just stop listening to my friends and eat my darn cookie.
Mm-hmm.
And then from there, everything goes back into the conversation. And it's... Slowly Growing on Me is one of my favorites because of that disconnect where I know where the math is in this, but I don't expect the audience to do so as well. And so it's my responsibility as a composer that they're enjoying what they hear, whether they know all of the math that I put into it. But that one feeds into probably the most homage-laden movement, which is Dirty Bastard, based off of Founder's Dirty Bastard Scotch Ale at O'Shaughnessy's Public House in Ravenswood.
Cool.
And that, it is. It's based off of beer, and it's based off of beer with the name of Bastard in it, which was fun for me because it allowed me to strip everything away for art music and just insert my Celtic harp roots, which is how I started in learning how to play harp. Tons of Celtic melodies, tons of the fun things. My harp that I grew up with was not an orchestral harp. It was a Celtic, or just a little triplet harp that is on the Guinness label. I mean, if you need a visual for it. And there's a lot of, I don't know, Holst, Granger, these classic wind band composers kind of harking back to their successes and what I grew up with and loving wind ensemble music.
Yeah.
My dad was my band director, and so there were things that he instilled in me of sounds that I loved in playing in his bands that I definitely put back into this one.
Cool.
That was a very long tangent.
No. That's, honestly, with the podcast, that's the dream. The dream is me talking as little as possible and just people. I don't like Marc Maron does this sometimes, where like sometimes he just like talks too much. It's like, dude, like, and I'm thinking about it myself right now. I'm like, I'm talking too much. Cool. I love the third movement when you were talking about Lincoln Station and talking about. I think it's so interesting the classical music culture right now. Because there are more and more people. I mean, I think, like, there are obvious critiques to how we handle education as a society. But I think it's really hard to deny that there are more people being trained classically and to a greater extent now than there were, like, 60 or 70 years ago or something like that. I don't know, actually. Now that I say that out loud, let me know what you think to that, everybody listening. Right into the show. Do you think there are more or less people that are, like, that are extremely educated in a artistic field, be it classical music, be it theater, all of these things, than there were 60 or 70 years ago? Or even, let's say 400 years ago, where, like, you only learned music by apprenticeship, and then everyone else mostly just, like, worked a day job. You have a lot of thoughts.
I have a lot of thoughts, and I don't want to go into them.
Yeah.
I think that's an unfair question according to a population that's already dealing with overcrowding. I don't think it's necessarily we're training too many. I think there's more people in the world today.
Right. Well, yeah, and so, I more meant it as a testament to that.
Sure.
Like, yeah. There is just more population. But I guess my thing is, by the sheer numbers of it, we've kind of created a much stronger... I'm basically thinking about... Have you ever seen that meme page, the classical music memes for contemporary teens?
I don't think I have.
Oh, it's so good. Okay. They just make memes of... It's a lot of bashing the white, straight, male establishment of classical music, too, which is really cool.
Fair.
I think, like, Ed Davis and, like, John Hanau all like and comment on all their posts, too. I love that page. I always check it out. But I just think it's so amazing that we have... There are a couple. There's, like, poor anesthetic art memes for music-loving teens or something. There's another one, too. There's all of these... First off, I just love that that's where we're at in society, where we just have all of these, like, stupid meme pages for, like, you know...
Sure.
If you follow British politics, like Jeremy Corbyn's dank meme stash is a thing. Or, like, Bernie Sanders had a dank meme stash.
Sure.
And it's just so interesting. And I think it's just so interesting to have that culture and then also see that kind of applied in music.
Sure.
It's just that's what made me think of when you were talking about, like, having conversations with other people that are highly trained in the same field as you. Because they're both, like, extremely thrilling and also extremely isolating.
Sure.
Yeah. Okay, so skillet cookie and then beer.
Beer.
O'Shaughnessy's.
Yeah. This is probably the movement that people are going to walk away whistling if they walk away whistling anything from this concerto. Every third Wednesday at O'Shaughnessy's, they have live Irish music.
Cool.
And so I was first introduced to the night by Joel Cross. And every time I go to a new place in Chicago, just because I'm nosy and don't know any better, thanks Dad, I ask them, what are the recommendations?
Right.
And so I get there, I'm looking at a beer list that's longer than everywhere in my hometown combined. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, what would you recommend? And she's like, the Dirty Bastard's pretty great. And so I had that. I loved it. Ordered some food and listened to live Irish music. And mm-hmm. the way that they deal with their live Irish music, it's really cool. They'll call out a tune, but anybody can join.
Right.
And so they'll call out a tune, they'll play it. And they'll play it so everybody's got it. And they'll play it a few times and then morph into another tune. And so the form that my movement ended up taking was a modified rondo form.
Cool.
Where eventually by the end, everything that you've heard in the past three movements has found its way back into a giant climax.
Cool.
And so, yeah, that was so much fun. I love Irish Night there.
Yeah. So Maureen's Irish, part Irish. And so she goes back to Ireland a lot, and I've learned a lot about Irish more than ever I did in school. About Irish kind of song tradition and music tradition, and it's so rich and so interesting, and it is so, like, pick up and join in, you know, it's there is that, always that energy of, we want everyone that's listening to also sing, it's inclusive to the utmost.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so my next question is, obviously, there are obvious reasons why you chose harp,
mm-hmm.
but I'm curious, what are the things, as you've been working with it and kind of and toying with it musically as a composer and listening to the rehearsal process and working on it, you know, in school and everything, what are the things that you found that the harp provides as a voice for this kind of, for like, survey into Chicago cuisine? And if that's a...
Oh, gosh.
That's a big question. I just think it's interesting because it's, you know...
Selfishly,
you mentioned it's the Guinness... It's right on the label there, yeah.
Selfishly, I didn't let myself get that philosophical with having it be harp.
Mm-hmm.
I knew I wanted to write a piece, a living piece of music that would work for a young harpist.
Cool.
80% of my immediate family are music educators. And one of my personal, very specific feelings regarding new music, new composers, new everything... is that we're leaving behind our students. So when you write a piece of new music, people teach Schubert for a reason.
Mm-hmm.
People teach the 24 classic Italian art songs for a reason, because they're meeting the student's voice level at a very specific point. Or you're doing a Handel flute sonata because you can teach somebody how to do it at a tempo that they're going to understand, mm-hmm. in a musical language that they're going to understand. I personally believe that students are the most left behind group when writing new music. There's new music being written all the time for like grade one, grade two bands, but there could be more.
Mm-hmm.
There's music being written for high school groups, but there could be more. And especially soloists, there really isn't a good book of living American art song for freshmen who might be just learning how to read music. They really love to sing, but they're training their ear, they're training how their body works. And the same goes for harpists, where so much of the music that I was playing for my ear to recognize or for my fingers to understand, the composer's been dead for 50 to 100 years or even more.
Mm-hmm.
And that bothered me. And that's the main reason I wrote a harp concerto. And, you know, going along with that, I've been working with CSW on putting this together for a little over a year now. It's been just a great journey. But even in putting together this concert, they're like, hey, we have a couple other pieces on this concert, which are also all by currently residing in America, female composers.
Cool.
And they asked me, they're like, hey, does that harp that you're renting, like, serve as an actual harp? Would you want to maybe play on this other piece? Like, a harp is a needed instrument in wind ensemble these days, which is the perfect reason why I knew that I was doing the right thing in writing a never-before-written harp concerto that was with wind ensemble. The amplified element of it is I wanted to have a large wind ensemble.
Mm.
I didn't want to have 15 total players to balance the sound of an acoustic, and you could stick a microphone down inside of an acoustic harp.
Mm-hmm.
But Lyon and Healy had an electroacoustic that I could rent, where you plug it in like a guitar. You can run it through 100 different filters, and it sounds awesome.
So cool. I didn't realize that was happening.
Yeah, they have one, and so we rented it for the premiere.
Does how often do you get to use a harp like that?
For the month.
No. So I mean, how much music is written for a harp like that?
None. It's like brand new as of a year or two ago.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
So, like Jordan, where Jordan is, like a brilliant harpist. So are you? I'm not.
No. No, he is amazing. I couldn't imagine right now working with somebody else.
Yeah.
Because we have an amazing rapport. He's so honest with me, where he's like, I can play this, but you know, freshman sophomore me couldn't.
Mm.
And so that's been great. That's been great feedback for me, where it's like, I know where my skills are at and I could play it, but am I writing it to the right level?
Yeah.
So it's been amazing.
Right. No, that's super interesting. I'm also super interested in when you're a classically trained harpist, and you know, the tone and the aesthetic and the sound is very much one thing. When you bring in that kind of level of electroacoustic amplified harp, like, what's the major difference? Like, what do you come to it and go, like, this is different? Like, is it just tone, or?
I think it's tone. The instrument itself doesn't resonate as well as an acoustic harp,
mm-hmm.
because the soundboard is filled, every string,
right.
every string has a pickup on it.
Yeah.
So we can do a bunch of fun things with it, but I didn't write it specifically for that style 2000 SG electroacoustic harp. I want to make sure that it gets other performances where you could just put a microphone inside of the body of the harp.
Got it.
But if I selfishly knew that harp existed, it was in Chicago, it was available for rent, and would enhance the recording, would enhance everything that I wanted for this premiere.
Well, and you get
so you
both sides
it the same.
Right. You get both sides of it, where you get this kind of, like, you get to have this heightened, if you want to say, experience with the electroacoustic.
Yes.
But then you also, it's also something that, because I think another big part of being a freshman, sophomore musician in any field is having something to look forward to.
Yes.
You know? And I think that riding that balance of finding something that a freshman and sophomore can play, but then also will want to play in 10 years.
Yes.
You know?
Absolutely.
Cool. Yeah. Yeah. So as a composer, I know this about you.
I'm very scared about what's about to come out of your mouth.
Well, no. I just know that you have, a style, like a very specific style, and I think that it's, I know I've heard you talk a lot about new music and kind of, and your thoughts on it, and I also know that you're very much involved with the musical theater tradition.
Yes.
How is this piece similar, and how is this piece different?
Oh goodness. Well, different, there's no words. It tells a very abstract story that I control. It's a classical piece of music. It's a band mm-hmm. piece. In terms of similarity, I approach writing anything the same way, where I believe that you have to have three sides of satisfaction to writing music. If you imagine it like a triangle, your musician has to be satisfied with the level that you're asking them to play at.
Mm-hmm.
So if you approach, I've talked with several vocalists about this as well, where if you're writing something for a younger group and you tell a vocalist, I'm looking for a really great recording of this so younger people have something to look up to, they don't feel insulted by the level that you've written it at.
Yeah.
But you should also be always be approaching your soloist or your performers, understanding where their level of music is at. Mm-hmm. Your audience should never feel talked down to. I believe that in writing music, you should ask your audience to maybe come 20% and you as the composer meet them at 80%. Mm-hmm. So they do have to work towards experiencing something completely new, but not to the point where it's above their education level, intelligence level. There's so much of that we're leaving audiences behind. And we can't expect them to enjoy new music if they don't understand it and it's their fault.
Yeah.
So that's the second side of it. And then as a composer, you should feel true to yourself and what you're writing and not feel like you're pandering to a certain audience, or you're also writing something for the sake of people say you should write this. Mm-hmm. There has to be that equal triangle of everybody aiming for the exact same artistic thing. And I approach my musical theater writing the same way that I write band music for that reason.
Cool. I'm really glad you said that. I think I had the weirdest conversation with my Lyft driver, because I was talking to him also about the Lyric Opera. And this is a critique I have frequently. Obviously, the Lyric Opera puts on great performances. I'm not saying anything about that. But I just think, you know, when you have this conversation of accessibility and making classical music more accessible and making it more easy to understand, you have to recognize that there is a reason for that. I'm basically talking about, I love the way that you said that as a creative, we do really need to at least go more than half. Obviously, the audience needs to work to understand it. Mm-hmm. But, like, the fact of the matter is, like, I feel like there are a lot of people that put on opera or put on classical music that they put it on, and then they put it on for like $40 a performance or $50 a performance, and then they're like, why are we not selling out? Or why is it that this isn't sustainable? And it's I really think it's because, first off, most people that do know classical music at this point, people that are highly educated, are weirdly the most poor right now. People that have trained in classical music are some of the most low-income people I know. And obviously there are people that went to school like on their parents' dime or something like that. And some people that got great scholarships. I'm also not entirely trying to shit on people with rich parents, but I'm a little. And but I think my point is, There is an education price and a literal price on performers, on performances in this kind of, especially in opera. And, you know, but then you think about the majority of people in society that don't know anything about opera and can barely afford to do it. We're like, yeah, maybe 40, yeah, like recognizing that $40 or $50 is a price that you would pay to go to something when you set the price of your opera. But the majority of people in the world, if you want to say in Chicago, don't know anything about opera, and they have no reason to pay $40 for something they don't know about that's in another language. Why would they do that? And I'm not saying that opera should be not performed. I'm just saying that, like, more affordable. I think that's the reason why, like, the audience for opera is getting more and more expensive. I also don't mean to like get into the nuances of operatic audiences with you, because I know that's not, I know you're like,
sure.
But I really appreciate your mind on that, because I think that we need to think more that way generally.
I think it's a concert culture problem,
yeah.
Honestly, more than anything. Every few times a year, I go to New York for what I like to call an attitude adjustment.
Mm.
And when I'm out there, I see 4 shows in 3 days.
Okay,
musical theater or plays, because I love musical theater. And I spend so much time in Chicago around concert culture, where you go, and the only word I can describe concert culture is emotionally constipated.
Mm.
You are only allowed to reach a 6 in emotion, whether it's joy, whether it's sorrow. And when did classical music stop being a gateway for us to feel emotion and mm-hmm. express emotion? And I feel that performers are allowed to do that, but we've stopped letting our audience do that for the sake of, I don't know what you want to call it, recording. making sure that you have a clean live recording, mm-hmm. or making sure that everybody's enjoying themselves and you're not imposing on someone else. Whereas the Broadway culture, if they love something, they let you know.
Yeah.
If they are sad, that you allow yourself to cry. I've never heard more audible sobs than I did during the second act of Dear Evan Hansen.
Mm.
Just everyone in that audience was letting themselves feel. And it was the perfect show to do so. The same could be said for everything that I saw that weekend. But musical theater has grasped and captured the general public in saying, yes, we're here to help you sort out whatever emotions that you need to, and you can do that from your audience seat.
Mm-hmm.
And concert culture hasn't allowed for that. But you're starting to see the breakdown of that.
Right.
You're starting to see more people do talkbacks, more breaking that fourth wall outside of the stage where the performers are meeting the audience and saying, yes, let's talk about this. Musicians Who Brunch, done by Brunch Project Productions, is fantastic mm-hmm. at that, where they do the performance. It's all new music. Some of it may have been performed before, but it's new music by living composers. Let's get together and drink and eat and talk with each other before and after all of this. Dessa, a hip-hop artist from the Twin Cities area, just performed with the Minnesota Orchestra, and I heard it was fantastic and just breaking down that cement wall of concert culture.
Yeah, we've put classical music so far up on a pedestal, and I almost wonder if we're going to be able to get it back.
I think you will, but I'm not convinced it'll happen on the A-level stages.
I agree. That's a conversation we're having a lot about the idea of like establishment versus like the edge of kind of being outside of establishment.
Sure.
Cool. Well, we only have a couple minutes left.
Sure.
You were worried about filling up 55 minutes, and I told you that we were going to fill it up, because you're brilliant and well-spoken.
Well, thank you.
So, the last thing we do with all of our guests, and I warned you about this before we started, is a one-minute plug for any upcoming events.
Okay.
And it doesn't always have to be that. Sometimes it is obvious. Sometimes, like, if you have a premiere of a concerto coming up or anything like that, then it is very obvious what you would plug. But you can also talk about, you know, people that you think are doing dope work, or things that you do for self-care, favorite restaurants, favorite books, favorite anything, really.
Oh, gosh. Okay. So, my one-minute plug is that my master's thesis, The Appetite Concerto for Amplified Harp and Wind Ensemble, is getting its world premiere at the Chicago High School for the Arts next Saturday, the 27th at 8 o'clock p.m. with the Chicago Symphonic Winds, conducted by Dr. Erica Neidlinger with soloist Jordan Thomas. Before the concert, we're having a panel discussion at 7 p.m. that we're discussing the intersectionality of living music, which I'm super excited for, because the entire program is all female composers that are currently residing in America. Other composers on the program whom I look up to very much are Joan Tower, Augusta Reed Thomas, and Chen Yi. And then my piece is rounding out the program. I'm currently halfway through the third season of Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, and I love it very much. And yeah, what's the best food I've had recently? Mariano's had a really good guacamole that I bought last week.
So. Nice.
I think that's about it.
Cool.
Any other questions?
No, no, that was very thorough. Cool. Well, thank you all so much for listening. I've been Daniel Johansson, and Maureen somewhere continues to be Maureen Smith. I will say, Maureen, if you're listening, that this was a fantastic conversation. I very much miss having her hair. She's fucking fantastic.
Same.
If you liked what you heard, if you are new to the show, there are lots of ways that you can keep up with us. You can head over to scopymag.com. That is our homepage. That's where we keep all of our articles. We keep a list of recent episodes of the podcast there. Other than that, you can also keep up with us on social media. You can over to Scopy Magazine on Facebook. You can also find us on Instagram and Twitter at Scopy Mag. We're also on YouTube under, I think it's Scopy Magazine. And the reason I mention that is because we just released yesterday a new Scoppy Studio. That was yesterday's episode. Obviously, you heard it, but if you heard it and wish that you could have seen it, well, do I have good news for you. You can head over to our Facebook page, Scoppy Magazine, and find the video of the performance that we aired on the podcast. Sorry, I'm gassy. There's also a second video up on the Facebook of basically B-sides. What ended up happening was we do Scoppy Studio here in the apartment, and the second half was the violinist just playing. So it was Bach and Beethoven Ensemble, Heidi. And it was
I'm working with them later this summer.
Cool. Yeah, they're doing the Celtic summer.
Yeah.
Our Gaelic summer, rather. Sure. I'm sorry. So they just played like folk tunes from the British Isles.
Awesome.
Is that all inclusive? The Welsh,
yes.
Scottish, Irish, British. So that was really fucking cool. But the thing that happened was we recorded this on Saturday, and my Saturday was fucking batshit. Where I literally got here at 3:30 and then had to leave at 4:30, and so I forgot to record audio for the second set of things. So we were gonna release all of it on the podcast, including the fiddle tunes, but I basically didn't get a clean cut of audio on for the fiddle tunes. But if what we did do is we put up the audio from the cameras. So if you want to check that out, it doesn't sound that bad actually. You please do that. It's on our Facebook and other videos there, and also on YouTube. Cool. I'm also going to do Maureen's bit. If you haven't heard that, I'm so sorry that I'm just talking now for 5 minutes at the end of the episode, Heidi. But the other thing that we care about a lot, oh my God, I don't even know how she starts this, is donations. If you are listening to us frequently, if you like what you've heard, please consider donating to the show. It means the world to us, absolutely means the world to us. I mean, we do this. We have a small budget that we do work on, and we're able to do different things, but we're trying to do a lot of stuff. Like, one of the things we're doing over the summer is this giant performance series where we're hiring, we're trying as hard as we can to make sure that everyone that's involved with it is seeing some kind of compensation, and if they're not, they're getting free recordings out of it. But I mean, you know, just the nature of all the things we're trying to do, having a budget would be such a huge deal. And the other thing is that we're very much trying to keep everything we do free. So all our performances are free performances. All of our articles are free. All of our podcast episodes are free. And the way that we can keep that going is if the people that can afford to donate to do that. Because what that means is that there are people out there that enjoy all of our content and love listening and love participating. But they can't afford to do it. And so when people that can afford to do it are stepping in to help out those that can't, that's really the dream. Because, you know, I mean, Maureen and I were talking about this today. Like, we want this to be full time for us. We want this to be everything. We want to do as much as we can. We want to do 5 episodes a week regularly. We want to be putting up 4 or 5 articles a week. We want this to be big. We want this to be huge. And the only way that we can really do that is with your help. So please, if you can, donate. And if you can't donate, then listen, participate, and share, as Maureen says at the end of every show. So, cool. Thanks again so much for listening. I've been Daniel Johansson. Go out and make something.